The Biography of Jonathan Edwards by Cyrano Dwight. Chapter 13, His First Interview with David Brainerd. In September of 1743, Mr. Edwards, while attending a public commencement in New Haven, first became acquainted with David Brainerd, then a missionary at Conemaugh. Brainerd, when a sophomore in college, in consequence of some indiscreet remarks uttered in the ardor of his religious zeal, respecting the opposition of two of the faculty to the preaching of George Whitefield, but which a generous mind would have wholly disregarded, had been expelled from the college. As this was the commencement at which his class were to receive the degree of Bachelor of Arts, he came to New Haven to attempt a reconciliation with the faculty, and made to them a truly humble and Christian acknowledgment of his fault. "I was witness," says Jonathan Edwards, "to the very Christian spirit which Brainerd showed at that time, being then at New Haven, and one whom he thought fit to consult on that occasion. There truly appeared in him a great degree of calmness and humility, without the least appearance of rising a spirit for any ill treatment which he supposed he had suffered, or the least backwardness to abase himself before those who, as he thought, had wronged him. What he did was, without any objection or appearance of reluctance, even in private to his friends to whom he freely opened himself, earnest application was made on his behalf, that he might have his degree then given him, and particularly by the Reverend Aaron Burr of Newark, one of the correspondents of the Honorable Society in Scotland, he being sent from New Jersey to New Haven by the rest of the commissioners for that end. And many arguments were used, but without success. He desired his degree as he thought it would tend to his being more extensively useful, but still, when he was denied it, he manifested no disappointment nor resentment. I have already alluded to the numerous separations of individual members from the churches to which they belonged, which occurred about this period, and usually for the alleged lack of piety either of the minister or of the church. As these commonly took place without a regular dismission, it became a practical question of some interest how the withdrawing members should be treated. Mr. Edwards, having been consulted on the subject with reference to some of the members of the Second Church in Hartford, who had thus withdrawn, addressed the following letter to the minister of that church. To the Reverend L. Nathan Whitman of Hartford, Connecticut, Northampton, February 9, 1744. Reverend and dear sir, Mr. P. was here this week and requested my opinion with respect to the proper treatment of a number of persons who have absented themselves from your meeting and have since attended public worship elsewhere. I declined giving an opinion except a very general one to him, but on reflection, have concluded to express my thoughts to you as a friend, leaving to attach to them such weight as you may see cause. As to differences among professing Christians of opinion and practice about things that appertain to religion and the worship of God, I am ready to think that you and I are agreed. As to the general principles of liberty of conscience and that men's use and methods with their neighbors to oblige them to a conformity to their sentiments or way is in nothing so unreasonable as in the worship of God, because that is a business in which each person acts for himself with his Creator and Supreme Judge, is one concerned for his own acceptance with Him, and on which depends his own and not his neighbor's eternal happiness and salvation from everlasting ruin. And it is an affair in which every man is infinitely more concerned with his Creator than he is with his neighbor. And so I suppose that it will be allowed that every man ought to be left to his own conscience and what he judges will be most acceptable to God, or what he supposes as the will of God as to the kind or manner or means of worship, or the society of worshippers he should join with in worship. Not but that a great abuse may be made of this doctrine of liberty of conscience and the worship of God. I know that many are ready to justify everything in their own conduct from this doctrine, and I do not suppose that man's pretense of conscience is always to be regarded, when made use of to justify their charging the society of worshippers they unite with, or the means of their worship, or indeed the same kind or manner of their worship. Men may make this pretense at times under such circumstances, that they may obviously be worthy of no credit in what they pretend. It may be manifest from the nature and circumstances of the case, in their own manner of behavior, that it is not conscience but petulancy and malice and willfulness, an obstinacy that influenced them, and therefore it seems to me evident that when such pleas are made, those that are especially concerned with them as persons that are peculiarly obliged to take care of their souls have no other way to do but to consider the nature and circumstances of the case, and from this to judge whether the case be such as will admit of such a plea, and whether the nature of things will admit of such a supposition, that the men act conscientiously in what they do, considering all things that appertain to the case. And in this, I conceive, many things are to be considered and laid together, as the nature of that thing is the subject of controversy, or wherein they differ from others, or have changed their own practice, the degree in which it is disputable, or how it may be supposed liable to diversity of opinion, one way or the other, as it is agreeableness to the Word of God, and as to the importance of it with regard to men's salvation or the good of their souls, the degree of knowledge or ignorance of the persons, the advantages they had for information or the disadvantages they have been under, and what has been in their circumstances that might mislead the judgment, the principles that have been instilled into them, the instructions they have received from those of whose piety and wisdom they have had a high opinion, which might misguide the judgment of persons of real honesty and sincerity, and tender conscience, the example of others, the diversity of opinion among ministers, the general state of things in the land, the character of the persons themselves and the manner of their behavior in the particular affair in debate. Now, sir, with regard to those persons that have gone away from you, however you may look upon their behavior in this as very disorderly, yet if you suppose, a case being considered with all of its circumstances, that there was any room for charity, that it might be through infirmity, ignorance, and error of judgment, so that they might be truly conscientious in it, that is, might really believe it to be their duty, and what God required of them to do as they have done, you would, I imagine, by no means think that they ought to be proceeded with in the use of such means as are proper to be used with contumacious offenders, or those that are stubborn and obstinate in scandalous vice and willful wickedness, or that you would think it proper to proceed with persons towards whom there is this room left for charity, that possibly they may be honest and truly conscientious, acting as persons afraid to offend God, so as to cut them off from the communion of the Lord and cast them forth into the visible kingdom of Satan, to be as harlots and publicans. I remain, Reverend Sir, your friend and brother, Jonathan Edwards. In May of 1743, Mr. Edwards went, as he often did, to Boston, to attend the convention of the clergy, which is held the day after the general election. He was on horseback and had his eldest daughter on a pillion behind him. At Brookfield, they fell in company with the Reverend Mr. Thomas Clapp, rector of Yale College, his wife and his son-in-law also on horseback with several others, all traveling in the same direction, and Mr. Edwards joined the company. He rode side by side with Mr. Clapp during a considerable part of the journey. At the commencement of Harvard College in the following year, 1744, Thomas Clapp stated before a large number of gentlemen, both at Boston and Cambridge, that while riding through Leicester in May of the year preceding, he was informed by Mr. Edwards that George Whitfield told him that he had the design of turning out of their places a greater part of the ministers of New England, and of supplying their pulpits with ministers from England, Scotland, and Ireland. This statement surprised those who heard it. Yet coming from such a source it was believed and extensively circulated, Mr. Edwards heard of it with astonishment and without hesitation denied that he had said so. Mr. Clapp, hearing of this denial, addressed a letter to Mr. Edwards dated October 12, 1744, in which he stated anew the alleged conversation in the same terms. But before the latter received it, he had forwarded a letter to Mr. Clapp dated October 18, 1744, showing him his mistake and calling on him to correct it. On October 29th, he wrote a reply to Mr. Clapp's letter of the 12th, and receiving another dated October 28th before he sent it, he replied to that also in the postscript, under the date of November 3rd. Mr. Clapp, finding that Mr. Edwards' contradiction of his statement was believed, and having heard, though incorrectly, that Mr. Edwards was about to publish such a contradiction, and cautiously publish a letter to his friend in Boston, in which he not only reasserted his former statement, but declared to Mr. Edwards in his private correspondence with him on the subject and made a declaration equally full and strong to the same point. Mr. Edwards published a reply in a letter to his friend in Boston dated February 4, 1745, in which he gave his two letters of October 18th and October 29th, with the postscript of November 3rd, from which it appears that instead of admitting the truth of Mr. Clapp's statement, he had most explicitly and solemnly denied it, and in order to show how Mr. Clapp might have been led into the mistake, acknowledged that he himself supposed that George Whitefield was formerly of the opinion that unconverted ministers ought not to be continued in the ministry, and that he himself supposed that George Whitefield endeavored to propagate this opinion, and a practice agreeable to it, and that all he had ever stated to anyone was his own opinion merely, and not any declared design of George Whitefield. He also admitted that Mr. Whitefield told him he intended to bring over a number of young men to be ordained by the ministers' tenants in New Jersey. He then asked whether this is the same thing as Mr. Clapp asserted, and suggests a variety of arguments which seem absolutely conclusive that he could never have made such a statement. All this occurred at a period of great excitement, when many ministers had been removed and many churches rent asunder, and when the minds of men were of course prepared beforehand to believe everything that favored their own side of the question. Mr. Clapp was in this case obviously mistaken. Still, he was truly a man of respectability and worth. He had a powerful mind, rich in invention and stored with knowledge, was profoundly versed in mathematics, physics, and astronomy, as well as the principles of law, and proved an able instructor and governor of the institution over which he presided. He was elected by a board of trustees exclusively Arminian in sentiment, and all his associates in office held the same tenets. At the same time, though he entered warmly into the controversy relative to George Whitefield, from a full conviction that it was his design to occasion the separation of churches, and to procure as far as possible the ejectment of all whom he regarded as unconverted ministers, and was doubtless happy in supposing himself able to prove that such was his avowed design, on the testimony of one of his warmest friends, yet he was far from taking the low ground of orthodoxy assumed by many on the same side, but always adhered to the doctrines of grace and ultimately became their champion. Some time after this, he showed his magnanimity by introducing the essay on the freedom of the will as a classic in the college. In August 1744, Jonathan Edwards preached a sermon entitled The True Excellency of a Gospel Minister at the ordination of Mr. Robert Abercrombie to the ministry of the gospel at Pelham. This gentleman was from Scotland, having been made known to Mr. Edwards by his correspondents in that country, and through his kind offices was introduced to the people of Pelham. The sermon was immediately published. The reader will probably recollect that Mr. McCulloch, in his letter of August 13, 1743, had expressed the opinion that the Church of God, previous to her ultimate extension and triumph, was destined to meet with more extensive and formidable trials than she had ever before experienced. Mr. Edwards, from a minute investigation of the scriptural prophecies, having been convinced that this, which was at that time the commonly received opinion of the Church, was erroneous, expresses his dissent from it in the following answer. To the Reverend Mr. William McCulloch, Northampton, March 5, 1744. Reverend and dear sir, I return you thanks for your most obliging, entertaining, and instructive letter dated August 13, 1743, which I received about the latter end of October, my answering which has been unhappily delayed by reason of my distance from Boston and not being able to find any opportunity to send there till the ship was gone that brought your letter, which I much regretted. My delay to answer has been far from arising from any indifference with respect to this correspondence, by which I am sensible I am highly honored and privileged. 'Tis probable that you have been informed by other correspondents before now what the present state of things is in New England. It is indeed, on many accounts, very melancholy. There is a vast alteration within these 2 years for about so long, I think it is, since the Spirit of God began to withdraw, and its great work has been on the decline. Great numbers in the land about 2 years ago were raised to an exceedingly great height and joy and elevation of mind, and through lack of watchfulness and sensibleness of the danger and temptation that there is in such circumstances, many were greatly exposed, and the devil taking the advantage, multitudes were soon and to themselves insensibly led far away from God and their duty. God was provoked that he was not sanctified in this height of advancement, as he ought to have been. He saw our spiritual pride and self-confidence, and the polluted flames that arose of intemperate, unhallowed zeal, and he soon in a great measure withdrew from us, and the consequence has been that the enemy has come in like a flood, in various respects, until the deluge has overwhelmed the whole land. There had from the beginning been a great mixture, especially in some places, of false experiences, and false religion with true. But from about this time the mixture became much greater. Many were led away with sad delusions, and this opened the door for the enemy to come in like a flood in another respect. It gave great advantages to these enemies and opposers of this work, furnished them with weapons, and gave them new courage, and has laid the friends of the work under such disadvantage that nothing that they could do would avail anything to withstand their violence. And now it has come to that the work has put to a stop everywhere, and it is the day of the enemy's triumphs. But I believe also a day of God's people's humiliation, which will be better to them in the end than their elevations and raptures. The time has been amongst us when the sower went forth to sow, and we have seen the spring in which the seed sprang up in different sorts of ground, appearing then fair and flourishing. But this last spring, and when now see the summer, in which the sun is up with a burning heat, and that tries the sorts of ground, and now appears the difference. The seed in stony ground, where there was only a thin layer of earth on a rock, withers away, the moisture being dried out. The hidden seeds and roots of thorns and unsubdued ground now spring up and choke the seed of the word. Many high professors are fallen, some into gross immorality, some into rooted spiritual pride, enthusiasm, and an incorrigible wildness of behavior, some into a cold frame of mind showing a great indifference to the things of religion. There are many, and I hope those, a greater part of those that were professed converts, who appear hitherto like the good ground, and notwithstanding the thick and dark cloud that soon follow that blessed sunshine that we have had, yet I cannot but steadfastly maintain a hope and persuasion that God will revive his work, and that what has been so great and very extraordinary is a forerunner of a yet more glorious and extensive work. It has been slanderously reported and printed concerning me that I have often said that the millennium has already begun, and that it began at Northampton. A doctor of divinity in New England has ventured to publish this report to the world, from a single person, who is concealed and kept behind a curtain. But the report is very diverse from what I have ever said. Indeed, I have often said, as I say now, that I looked upon the late wonderful revivals of religion as forerunners of those glorious times so often prophesied of in the Scripture, and that this was the first dawning of that light and beginning of that work, which in the progress and issue of it would at last bring on the church's latter-day glory. But there are many that know that I have from time to time added that there would probably be many sore conflicts and terrible convulsions and many changes, revivings and intermissions, and returns of dark clouds, and threatening appearances before this work shall have subdued the world, and Christ's kingdom shall be everywhere established and settled in peace, which will be the lengthening of the millennium or day of the church's peace, rejoicing and triumph on earth, so often spoken of. Let us go on what scheme we will. It is most apparent from the Scriptures that there are mighty strugglings to be expected between the Church of God and her enemies before her great victory. And there may be many lesser strugglings before the last and greatest and universal conflict. Experience seems to show that the Church of God, according to God's method of dealing with her, needs a great deal gradually to prepare her for that prosperity and glory that he has promised her on earth. As the growth of the earth, after winter, needs gradually to be prepared for the summer heat. I've known instances in which, by the heat's coming on suddenly in the spring without intermissions of cold to check the growth, the branches, many of them by too hasty a growth have afterwards died, and perhaps God may bring on a spiritual spring as he does the natural, with now and then a pleasant sunshiny season, and then an interruption of clouds and stormy winds, till at length, by the sun more and more approaching, and the light increasing, the strength of the winter is broken. Be extremely apt to get out of the right way. A very great increase of comfort that is sudden, without time and experience in many instances, has appeared to wound the soul in some respects, though it seems to profit it in others. Sometimes at the same time that the soul seems wonderfully delivered from those lusts that are more carnal and earthly, there is an insensible increase of those that are more spiritual, as God told the children of Israel that he would put out the former inhabitants of the land of Canaan by little and little, and would not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field should increase upon them. We need much experience to teach us the innumerable ways that we are liable to err, and to show us evil and pernicious consequences of those errors. If it should please God before many years to grant another great revival of religion in New England, we should perhaps be much upon our guard against such errors as we have run into, and which have undone us this time, but yet might run insensibly into other errors that now we think not of. You inquire of me, Reverend Sir, whether I reject all those for counterfeits who speak of visions and trances. I am far from doing of it. I am, and always have been in that manner, of the same opinion with James Robe that he expresses in those pamphlets that Mr. Malloran sent me. The persons are neither to be rejected nor approved on such a foundation. I have expressed the same thing in my discourse on the marks of a work of the Spirit of God, and have not changed my mind. I'm afraid, dear sir, that I've been too bold with you in being so lengthy and tedious, and have been too impertinent and forward to express my opinion upon this and that, but I consider myself as writing to a candid Christian friend and brother, with whom I may be free and bold, and from whom I may promise myself excuse and forgiveness, dear brother. Ask in your earnest prayers for me and for New England. Chapter 14, A Treatise on the Religious Affections. From the facts already recited, it will be obvious to the reader, to few ministers, even in the course of a long ministry, have as full an opportunity of learning from their own observation the true nature of a revival of religion, and the differences between imaginary and saving conversion, as Jonathan Edwards now enjoyed. He had early discovered that there was a radical difficulty attending not only every revival of religion, but in a greater or less degree also every instance of supposed conversion, a difficulty arising from erroneous conceptions, so generally entertained respecting the question, what is the nature of true religion, or what are the distinguishing marks of that holiness which is acceptable in the sight of God? Perceiving at an early period of his Christian life that no other subject was equally important to man, that no other was more frequently or variously illustrated by the scriptural writers, and yet, that on no other had professing Christians been less agreed, his attention, as he himself informs us, had been particularly directed to it from his first commencement of the study of theology, and he was led to examine it with all the diligence and care and exactness of search and inquiry of which his mind was capable. In addition to this, he not only had witnessed in two successive instances a solemn and universal attention to religion, among the young as well as among grown persons in his own congregation, and in both almost all of the latter, as well as very many of the former gathered into church, but he had been the spiritual counselor and guide of multitudes in other congregations, where he had occasionally labored, as well as of great numbers who visited him for this purpose at Northampton. These advantages of observation, it may easily be believed, were not lost on a mind like his. This subject, at the time of which we are speaking, had become also a subject of warm and extended controversy. The advocates of revivals of religion had too generally been accustomed to attach to the mere circumstances of conversion, to the time, place, manner, and means by which it was supposed to be effected, an importance nowhere given them in the Scriptures, as well as to conclude that all affections which were high in degree, and accompanied with great apparent zeal and ardor, were of course gracious in their nature, while their opposers insisted that all true religion did not consist at all in the affections, but wholly in the external conduct. The latter class attributed the uncommon attention to religion, which they could not deny had existed for 4 years in New England, to artificial excitement merely, while the former saw nothing in it, for in the measures taken to promote it, to condemn, but everything to approve. Mr. Edwards and his views of the subject differed materially from both classes, as he knew from his own experience that sin and the saving grace of God might dwell in the same heart. So he learned both from observation and testimony that much false religion might prevail during a powerful revival of true religion, and that at such a time multitudes of hypocrites might spring up among real Christians. Thus it was in the revival of religion in the time of Josiah, in that which attended the preaching of John the Baptist, in those which occurred under the preaching of Christ, in the remarkable outpouring of the Spirit in the days of the apostles, in that which existed in the time of the Reformation. He clearly saw that it was this mixture of counterfeit religion with true, which in all ages had given the devil his chief advantage against the kingdom of Christ. By this, observes Mr. Edwards, the cause of Christianity in and after the apostolic age, much more than by all the persecutions of both Jews and heathen. By this he prevailed against the Reformation, to put a stop to its progress, more than by all the bloody persecutions of the Church of Rome. By this he prevailed against the revivals of religion that have occurred since the Reformation. And by this he prevailed against New England to quench the love of her espousals about 100 years ago. And I think I have had opportunity enough to see plainly that by this the devil has prevailed against the late great revival of religion in New England, so happy and promising in its beginning. I have seen the devil prevail in this way against two great revivings of religion in this country. By perverting us from the simplicity that is in Christ, he has suddenly prevailed to deprive us of that fair prospect we had a little while ago of a kind of paradisic state of the Church of God in New England. End quote. These evils, it was obvious, must exist in the Church until their cause was removed, and men had learned to distinguish accurately between true and false religion. Contribute his own best endeavors for the accomplishment of this end, Mr. Edwards prepared and published a treatise on the religious affections. The great design of this treatise is to show in what true religion consists, and what are its distinguishing marks and evidences, and thus to enable every man who will be honest and faithful with himself to decide whether he is or is not a real Christian. Similar attempts had been made by many earlier writers, but it may, I believe, safely be asserted that no one of their efforts taken as a whole, and viewed as an investigation of the entire subject, would now be regarded in as high a degree as important as valuable. The subject itself is one of the most difficult which theology presents, and demands for its full investigation not only ardent piety and a most intimate acquaintance with the Scriptures, but an exact and metaphysical inspection of the faculties and operations of the human mind, which unfortunately very few writers on experimental religion have hitherto discovered. The work of Mr. Edwards is at once a scriptural and a philosophical view of the subject. Is truly scientific in its arrangement, and logical in its deductions as any work on the exact sciences, that it is also a thorough and complete view of it, we have this decisive evidence that no work of the kind of any value has appeared since, for which the author has not been indebted substantially to the treatise on the affections, or which has not been that very treatise in part or in whole diluted to the capacity of weaker understandings. The trial to which the mind of the honest, attentive, and prayerful reader of its pages is subjected is a very trial of the judgment day. He who can endure the trial of the treatise on the affections will stand unheard amidst a dissolving universe, and he who cannot will assuredly perish in its ruins. It ought to be the vade mecum, not only of every minister and every Christian, but every man who has sobriety of thought enough to realize that he has an interest in a coming eternity. Every minister should take effectual care that it is well dispersed among the people of its own charge, and that none of them is admitted to a profession of religion until, after a thorough study of this treatise, he can satisfy both himself and his spiritual guide, not only that he does not rely upon the mere negative signs of holiness, but that he finds within himself those distinguished and marked evidences of its positive existence, which the divine author of holiness has pronounced sure and unerring. It is indeed said that anxious inquirers will often be discouraged by this course, particularly by a perusal of the second part of the treatise, from making a profession of religion, and led to renounce the hope of their own conversion. And the answer is that he who, on finding himself discouraged from a profession of religion by the second part, is not encouraged to make it by a perusal of the third part. Thus, of course, his views are perverted by disease or melancholy, and consider the call to repent and believe the gospel is still addressed immediately to himself, and that he, on the perusal of this treatise, is led to renounce the hope which he had cherished of his own piety, while he has the best reason to regard it as a false hope, will find almost all, of course, that that hope is soon succeeded by one which will endure the strictest scrutiny. It is also said that many persons cannot understand this treatise, and the answer is that he who is too young to understand it in its substance is too young to make a profession of religion, and that he whose mind is too feeble to receive it substantially, when communicated by a kind and faithful pastor, cannot understandingly make such a profession. Eminently is this treatise necessary to every congregation during a revival of religion. It was especially designed by its author to be used on every such occasion, and a minister who then uses it as he ought will find it like a fan in his hand winnowing the chaff from the wheat. And to tell ministers, laying aside the miserable vanity which leads them in the mere number of those whom they denominate their spiritual children, to find an occasion of boasting, and of course to swell that number as much as they can, shall be willing thus faithfully and honestly to make a separation among their inquirers. Every revival of religion will open a great and effectual door through which the enemies as well as the friends of religion will gain an admission into the house of God. And when they're thus admitted, and the ardor of animal feelings is once subsided, the minister will generally find not only that he has wounded Christ in the house of his friends, but he has destroyed his own peace and that of his church, and prepared the way for his own speedy separation from his people. To prevent this miserable system of deception on the part of ministers and churches, as well as of candidates for a profession of religion, Mr. Edwards wrote the treatise in question. As at first prepared, it was a series of sermons which he preached from his own pulpit from the text still prefixed to it in 1 Peter 1, verse 8, whom, having not seen, you love, and whom, though you now see him not, yet believe in, you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. It was thus written and preached probably in the years 1742 and 1743, being afterward thrown into the form of a treatise by the author. It was published early in 1746. In its style, it is the least correct of any of the works of Mr. Edwards published in his lifetime, but as a work exhibiting genuine Christianity in distinction from all of its counterfeits, it possesses such singular excellence that were the books on earth destined to a destruction so nearly universal that only one besides the Bible could be saved, the Church of Christ, if aiming to preserve the volume of the greatest value to man, that which would best unfold to a bereaved posterity the real nature of true religion, would unquestionably select for preservation the treatise on the religious affections.